Good morning and welcome to Midpoint on WMNF, your midweek, mid-morning news and public affairs show where we examine world and national news through a local perspective. I'm your host, Janet Scherberger, and we have Lamar Robinson answering our phones for us today. So if you have questions or comments, give us a call at 813-239-9663 or email us at dj@wmnf.org. Or you can text us at 813-433-0885. Today, a special Wavemakers edition of Midpoint, where we go deep with someone who's making a difference in the Tampa Bay region. In the studio with me is Nasheed Madiun. Did I say that right? Close?
Yes, you're very close.
Executive Director of Florida Humanities. Welcome to Midpoint, Nasheed. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And it's Madiun's.
Madiun.
Okay.
Yeah, there we go.
And Florida Humanities is a nonprofit whose mission is to preserve and share the history, literature, and culture of Florida. They do that with special programming and exhibits, some done in partnership with the Smithsonian Institution and also by distributing grants funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities and as well as donors.
Right, right. As a matter of fact, Florida Humanities is a unique organization, a nonprofit that, for the most part, distribute money throughout the state of Florida, 67 counties, to support operations, support the preservation of culture and how we identify ourselves in this humanity.
Great. And this is WMNF Tampa that you're listening to with Nasheed Madiun.
Yeah.
Is that right?
We'll be okay. We'll be friends by the end.
Okay, great. Full disclosure, I do some freelance work for Florida Humanities. Nasheed worked at a number of museums before he came to St. Petersburg to lead Florida Humanities. He was notably the founding director of the Stax Museum of American Soul Music in Memphis. And so I asked him to give me some of his favorite songs by Stax recording artists. And we're going to play snippets of those throughout this hour. So stay tuned for that. What were the favorite songs of someone who was so close to Stax Records? Now, Nasheed, let's start with something very basic, something that I've been butchering, your name. It's an unusual name, but it's not actually the name you were born with, so tell us about that.
So in the late 60s and early 70s, a lot of African Americans found the freedom and the empowerment opportunity to identify themselves with cultures that were recognizable, and my father was a part of that movement. He was a student at the University of Arkansas and saw fit to have his name changed to reflect a part of himself, identity and criticism without regret. Nasheed Salim Madiun. I was born James Bingham, but that empowerment piece when I was 2 years old, I was a junior, so James Bingham Jr. now, Nasheed Salim Madiun.
What year was that?
I was born in 74, so okay. This is 76.
Okay, 76. Mm-hmm. And you stuck with that name then, obviously.
Right, so, right, yep. Yes.
You grew up in Helena, Arkansas.
Right.
And before we talk about that, let's hear a song you selected from Stax artist Albert King, who also changed his name. He was born Albert Nelson, and he grew up in Arkansas and started his musical journey there. This is I'll Play the Blues for You by Albert King. Do I have it? Let's see.
If you're down and out and you feel real hurt, come on. To the place where I was, and all your loneliness, I'll try to soothe.
Right.
Right.
That was I'll Play the Blues for You. You like that song?
Yeah, that Flying V guitar. He played it upside down, left-handed.
So let's talk about Helena. Right. It's an interesting place. It played a key role in the Civil War, black leadership during Reconstruction, and gospel and blues music. And you had an interesting upbringing there. Your father ran a newspaper out of your house. Were you involved in that?
Well, I was involved to the point where I helped to sell the newspapers, I guess. My father would give me 10 cents on every 35 cents sold. And it was an interesting time. But one of the things I learned from that experience was the confluence of personalities and backgrounds. My father's newspaper, The Community Consultant, it explored not just African-American experiences, but how the lives of people integrated throughout that region. Phillips County. Phillips County, a very depressed community along the Mississippi River, had a lot of challenges politically and socially. And he wanted to find a way to bring some of those topics to the forefront for discussion. And a lot of those discussions, of course, had to occur before it went to print. So you would have black and white individuals, writers and cartoonists, which that was my favorite, you know, I was 7, 8, 9 years old, in the front of the house discussing the issues of the day. So,
and what happened to the paper?
Well, my father and constituents, they had an issue with a school system challenge, and it led to teachers boycotting. And he saw it important. He saw it important to express the challenges and communicate that. And a lot of his advertisers pulled from that for fear of alignment. Even if they agreed, the alignment with those topics was worrisome politically. And of course, newspapers and a lot of institutions at that time rely on the funding from those. And paycheck to paycheck, month to month, he could not sustain that, so the newspaper fell.
So he was basically punished for taking a stand.
Right. Discipline right. and punishment.
What lesson did you learn from that? Was that something that stuck with you?
Well, integrity is one, but I do believe there are opportunities where you can share the truth in a democratic manner.
Mm-hmm.
So balancing the truth that needs to be told with the truth that, unfortunately, sometimes the public is not ready to reveal it in such a bold way, there's a way to do that. And so that is one of my biggest takeaways. Find a way to bring the truth in an egalitarian manner.
Well, great. We're going to talk about that a little bit more later, I think, when we talk about your work at FAMU. You earned your bachelor's and master's degree in history from universities in Mississippi, so this seems like a good time to hear something from one of your Stax recording artist song picks, Walking the Back Streets and Crying. maybe I've done that on occasion, from Little Milton. Little Milton was from Mississippi, and there's a marker for him on the Mississippi Blues Trail. This is Little Milton, walking the back streets and crying. That's Little Milton.
So the difference between those two songs, the guitar. So both were Gibsons with Albert King's Flying V, but Little Milton played a 335 semi-hollow body. And so if you ever get a chance to listen to those songs again, you can see the difference. And
back to back.
Yeah. So one of the interesting things about the display for Little Milton was that when he came in to look at his display, he said, well, I never stood up and played the guitar, and it had to be tilted. So we had to tilt the guitar to his specifications. So he was a remarkable individual.
So post-college, you worked at the Department of Arkansas Heritage, and one of the things that you did there was significant work on the 1919 Elaine Massacre, which I have never heard of. It does seem that every state has one of these tragedies. There's Oklahoma has Tulsa, and Florida has Rosewood. So what's the story of Elaine?
Well, it's very significant, actually. If you go to trial or court and you need to be tried by a jury of your peers, or there's a sense of due process that has to happen, jurisdiction involves, where the activity occurred and make sure that you have proper treatment. That came out of Moore versus Dempsey, a Supreme Court case in 1923. And this was the result of the Elaine race riots. The individuals who were accused of starting this riot in Elaine, Arkansas, eventually, through the support of the NAACP, their folks involved in Arkansas, made it to the Supreme Court and won that case. But you're looking at post-World War One activism. African-Americans, 19 to 23 years old, coming back from abroad and understanding that, you know, we as a people don't have to be treated a certain way. The price of cotton doubled, and sharecroppers were renting their right to make a living from the landlords, and there was an opportunity to surpass the direct sale of the profits to the landlords and go to Memphis. In Memphis, that was the factoring or the traders of cotton along Cotton Row. And imagine cotton per pound at 23 cents going to 50 cents. So now I have an opportunity to sell the cotton back to the landlord at their 23 cents and take a 27 cent profit and buy some land and do this myself. Mm-hmm. And you know, the landlords, realizing this gap in potential loss, which amounts to about $5 million 1919.
Wow.
You know, that's enormous. And no labor, right? No labor. And the following year, 1920s, you know, how can we stop this? Well, let's say it's a riot so we can get rid of this labor issue and get the land from them and force them to go back to tenant farming or sharecropping. National Guard came in because I'm so political maneuvering, and you have a race riot, which it was not. There's a long story behind it, but it became you know, one of the biggest massacres. A few hundred people died as a result, and these were just individuals who were in their homes. But the majority of the individuals who died were the leading sharecroppers of that area. And isn't that interesting? You know, Ida B. Wells had an opportunity through the Chicago Defender to list the individuals who died. So of these 200 or so people that died, how did just 97, it just so happened 97 of those individuals were the sharecroppers that were in control of this land and were seeking to surpass the landlords. So that was indicative of the wave across the South in Jim Crow, the rise of the second wave of the KKK political movements, because these African Americans, if they had the financial means and wherewithal, they would start to vote. And they were likely going to vote Republican. And they could not have that at the time.
Well, you talk about when you did your work at, you talk about the compression of black history. You're talking there about the right to the vote and black and African Americans actually becoming a middle class. And one of the things that I've heard you talk about before is the compression of black history, that we talk about black history from, we go from emancipation to MLK, but there's a lot of stuff right in between when you're, that happened. There's a lot that happened in that period of time also.
Yeah, this is the rise. We're talking about the rise of the black middle class. And considering that, you know, the Morrill Act in the 1860s and 1880s allowed for land grant colleges to pop up, Fisk University, Hampton, Howard. Eventually, you have Howard and Spelman, Tuskegee. These universities were providing doctors and lawyers and veterinarians to the community and educators. A lot of the educators in the 40s and 50s in the high schools had master's degrees in math and English and what have you. And so you have individuals that are now learned, and they can make a choice between, you know, entrepreneurship or going into higher education. That debate between the W.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington certainly applies to this time. Mm-hmm. But we skip it and not realizing that a lot of African-American businesses were popping up. That's the issue in Tulsa, Oklahoma. You know, you have a centered approach to economic development. I can buy my groceries, my clothing, my dry cleaning, all of that in one location and with people I know, support them and support their livelihood. Now we don't need the broader community. We can't have that either. So
right. The when you were at the Department of Arkansas Heritage, how much do they talk about music there? To what extent is music a part of Arkansas Heritage? I don't usually think of Arkansas as being a place where there's a lot of great music. You know, I think of Memphis and Tennessee and Mississippi. But tell me about what Arkansas.
So, goodness, I'm grinning now. Along the Mississippi River, you have on both sides levees, right? Levees to protect the water in case of a flood. And a lot of the workers in the rice fields, cotton fields, not really tobacco, but timber was a big industry in the early 1900s. They were also musicians, and they expressed themselves through music, blues, and gospel. And so there were a lot of what you call juke joints or nightclubs along the levees, and some of the musicians played there. B.B. King got his start there. But if you've heard of artists like Sister Rosetta Tharpe, Levon Helm, John Weston, Conway Twitty, they're all from the Arkansas Delta.
Well, this seems like a good time then to hear Little Bluebird from Johnny Taylor. He was born and raised in Arkansas and performed in gospel groups as a youngster. I remember his big hit Disco Lady from 1976, which he recorded after he left Stax, and we're not going to hold that song against him. So this is A Little Bluebird by Johnny Taylor.
She would sing for me, OJT. Yeah. I know a little bluebird.
All right, that's Little Bluebird by Johnny Taylor. Do you want to say anything about
Johnny
that?
Johnny Taylor, Al Green from Al Green as well from Arkansas, but Johnny Taylor also was part of this group called the Soul Stirrers. You know, we talked about gospel and its influence on soul and blues, but that was also the label that was headed up by Sam Cooke. Sam Cooke was also at one point part of Soul Stirrers. So a lot of these artists interacted with each other and performed together and had relationships. But that's a good song, Little Bluebird. Little Milton also did a very nice cover of that song.
Okay. That's a new one to me, Johnny Taylor. We've got an email or a text message from one of our listeners. I'm going to ask you this, Nasheed. He wants to know this is Bubba, who wants to know, what does your guest think about African-American cemeteries being paved over but now reclaimed? Have you been following that? I know this is...
Yeah, well, it just so happens, we were talking about the Department of Arkansas Heritage, and I had the opportunity to work with a wonderful group in Phillips County that received money from the state of Arkansas in the early 2000s to uncover grown over or paved over or, unkept cemeteries in that county. And it is certainly an issue. I think that, the religious heritage, the spiritual heritage of any community should be recognized. And, unfortunately, there was a time when the burial sites of African Americans were just, the crosses. And here lies African American, and here lies an uncle or a friend or however. And I think it's very disheartening. But organizations can come together and start to pursue ways to provide an education. Like Florida Humanities, with the organization that I head up now, would support dialogue. Mm-hmm. I think the more you communicate about the stories of some of these individuals, the slice of life happenings, and the contributions to society, the more we can make a push to preserve. Preservation of cemeteries, it costs money. It's perpetual. But communities have an obligation to do such.
Well, speaking of telling stories, you earned a degree in creative writing. And I'm curious about how has that helped your work at museums? And let me mention, those museums have included the Texas State History Museum and the Art Museum and Archives of Hampton University, as well as those archives at FAMU. So how did the creative writing degree come into play in that work?
Well, we were just talking about stories, and the research, the scholarship generally of our lives comes from academia, right? And you also have individuals that are authors that do a very good job of chronicling that. But when you walk through a museum, you're often walking through a museum with, you know, say a grandmother with a granddaughter. So you have sixth graders and fourth graders, and you have learned individuals walking through. You need to find a way to tell that story to everybody with one message. Mm-hmm. So that panel along the wall, well, today digital technology can do a lot, but traditionally, that panel is not going to change for 5 to 10 years, but it needs to tell an accurate story, an objective story. So creative writing allows you to find a balance between scholarship and general storytelling.
I went to the Stax Museum in May, and it was just an incredible experience for me. It was just unreal, life-changing. And Memphis is just a really super cool town. And right. One of the most interesting things to me about the story of Stax Records, and this is part of the history told in the museum, which I imagine you had a role in, is how it was an integrated studio at a time of great racial tension. And that was captured by the makeup of Booker T and the MGs. They were one of the first integrated rock bands. So this is an important part of the Stax history, isn't it?
Yes, it's very important. So imagine the music that you've heard throughout your life, coming out of unrest. There's peace and harmony and out of this chaotic time period, the 1960s. And this band just happened to jam together. So you have Steve Cropper, who's a prodigy guitar player and had a business sense and an opportunity to identify talent. You have Al Jackson Jr., and also a prodigy that was able to play in his dad's band, Al Jackson Sr., but could play the drums. He was considered the human timekeeper, right? So he played drums for Al Green down at High Studios, 14, 15, 16 years old. And Booker T, the namesake of the group, he was also a prodigy, 14 years old and could, produce music, play that Hammond B3 organ that we hear, the signature of the group. And they come together, black and white, and produce music that, it ends up influencing the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Bob Dylan. That is incredible considering just 2 miles north, you have the assassination of Martin Luther King at the Lorraine Motel. And Memphis, of course, right at the edge of Mississippi and Arkansas, is in a hotbed of KKK communities and demonstrations. And so to have that kind of peace and integration occur at a music studio on the south side of Memphis is incredible. And they produced some wonderful music that competed with the Philly soul sound and Motown as well.
Well, you mentioned the assassination of Martin Luther King in Memphis, which was not far from Stax. Right. And that also had an impact on Stax records. Tell me about that.
Well, a lot of the artists, the Staple Singers, Johnny Taylor, and the Rufus Thomas, Isaac Hayes, a lot of the artists felt they were not doing enough, right? And they started to work to find a way to make their music make sense and influence. Eventually, you could see the results in the writings of Isaac Hayes and Watts Stax. It's a seminal example of the way music can bring people together.
Well, tell our listeners what that is, because everybody may not know.
So if you've heard of this phrase, burn, baby, burn, in California, the burning of the Watts neighborhood in Los Angeles, California, there was a need to raise money for hospitals and healthcare and the black community, displaced black African-Americans in that area. So Stax came together, and the artists donated their time and efforts to that community. Of course, artists like Johnny Taylor were enterprising and played in a few clubs around town, but they raised the money needed to support the efforts of that community. You have Jesse Jackson, I Am Somebody, that comes out of that. Richard Pryor contributed. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Isaac Hayes and Johnny Taylor did the thing. Rufus Thomas controlling the crowd.
It was a concert. They did a big concert. Before Live Aid. It was a big concert.
Yeah, fundraising. It was amazing to have a record label contribute in that massive way.
That I guess that film was recently included in the Library of Congress for its cultural significance. 1920 or 2020, it was finally put in the Library of Congress, even though it came out, I think, in 1976. I'm not sure when the movie came out.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure when the movie came out, but a lot of artists and a lot of music heritage reflect on that era as black exploitation, black empowerment, and the ability of African Americans to utilize that musical influence to move a community.
Let's hear actually now from Booker T and the MGs. This is a classic, Green Onions, from Booker T and the MGs. That's Green Onions from Booker T and the MGs, and that will make you move. There's no way it can't.
And so those artists were just in the studio, but they were session musicians. You know, Otis Redding and the Tim Prees, a lot of the artists, Colin Rufus Thomas, they all used the same session musicians, same as Muscle Shoals or Motown. And they were just playing music between amongst each other between sessions. And Jim Stewart said, hey, you know, Jim Stewart, of one of the owners, said, this is really something. Do that again. You know, what, this Diddy? And so they recorded, and they realized that instrumental music was an opportunity and pathway. So they had a whole album as a result.
And so you were hired in 2001 as the founding director of the Stax Museum, and you were there when it was being built. It didn't open until 2003. What are some of your favorite pieces that are in the museum?
Goodness. We're talking about 20 years ago, and that collection was amazing. Every single that company put out, screwed in along a wall there and for display. And I had the opportunity to help to put all 916, 45.
So you were doing everything.
Yeah.
You were actually doing. And the other thing that I heard you did is you have some connection to the Isaac Hayes car. There's, if y'all have been there, there's a 1972 blue Cadillac Eldorado with a fur-lined interior, a TV, refrigerated bar, 24-karat gold trim, including gold windshield wipers, that's on display there on like a little rotating Lazy Susan type of thing, a giant one. But you had the opportunity to get behind the wheel of that car. Tell me about that.
So in this gold-plated 1972 peacock blue Eldorado was lost for a while. You know, Isaac Hayes had a bankruptcy, and the car ended up in Michigan.
Oh, my gosh.
And somehow a fire chief was able to get it out of auction in the late 80s, and it made its way back to Memphis, and it was in the basement for quite some time. And as we were developing the museum and the exhibits, we're actually looking for Isaac Hayes' gold chains to put on display. But we came across the car. Like, it's in such disrepair. The original company that helped outfit the car, Don's Upholstery, said, well, we'll donate the refurbished opportunity for the car. And so it took a few months. We had to wait. We wanted to figure out how to display it. So once it was done, we had to get it to the museum. It was the last piece because we had to come in on the north wall and seal it in, okay? So to ensure that nothing went wrong, we put it on a flatbed truck, and I got behind it. A lot of curators and directors want to stay with the prize artifact and possession. Mm-hmm. So we had a motorcade that went across town.
Oh, my gosh. That's
to the
so
south
cool.
side of Memphis, and everybody's waving like, wow, look at this car with these big gold headlights. And we backed the car in, and as the car was being backed in, I stayed with it to make sure that we can get through this tight opening onto the pedestal. And we had a mechanism that allowed the the car to turn. As a matter of fact, Isaac Hayes donated his sound for a period of time. If you tried to touch the car, it would say, "Get your hands off, partner." And so, you know, and the, you know, that, and that tone that he has. But that was an amazing experience, identifying the albums and the original handwritten sheet music. We even came across the partials of Otis Redding, and that he would, you know, sit on the firepiece when he recorded. We came across a lot of Rufus Thomas flamboyant costumes, and it was an amazing time and amazing stories we told.
Well, this is another one of your song picks. This is Walk On by Isaac Hayes. Love that guitar.
Mm.
Walk On by Isaac Hayes. So you actually, after Stax, went to Gibson Retail Group. Was that after Stax?
So Gibson Musical Instruments had a lot of divisions, and one of which was Discoveries of Gibson that morphed into a retail group of nightclubs and stores and exhibitions that the company sought to get from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Henry Juskowitz, the owner, was also on the board of Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and wanted to find a way to circulate these exhibits and recoup some of the costs. And Henry Juskowitz said, well, we can do that since we're in so many locations. And Isaac Hayes and David Porter were a songwriting duo with Stax, who also had a relationship with Gibson, and knew about the development of the Stax Museum, and so helped to bridge that gap in identifying someone who could tell the story. Maybe too young to be starstruck with some of the artists we would come across, but so the intent was to circulate wonderful exhibits that the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was doing.
Okay, so it was still part of right. your career as being a museum a professional. And then after, I might get the timing of this right off, but I know that before you joined Florida Humanities, right before you joined Florida Humanities, actually, you were director of the Southeastern Regional Black Archives and Research Center and Museum at FAMU.
Right.
It's a lot. It's a mouthful. but it has the largest collection of black artifacts in the Southeast.
Yes.
So what are some of the most important elements there? And if you could focus maybe on some of the Florida elements, that'd be great.
Well, I think the most significant element is the opportunity to tell tough stories
mm-hmm.
and find a way to have anybody who's visiting the South to realize exactly what it means to be a Floridian, a black Floridian, or, you know, be from this region. You know, the economics of the tobacco industry, the economics of the cotton industry, shipbuilding, and how it affected African Americans, but also the Hispanic community. So when we talked about the Rosewood incident, the massacre in the 20s earlier, you know, that was a reparations opportunity, and it went through the courts. All of the papers as a result of that interviewing collection and investigation, it's archived at, FAMU's Black Archives. But also, the rare books of our lives, the paintings like the Florida Highwaymen
mm-hmm.
that helped tell the story of Florida from Expressionism. You know, the culture of African Americans sometimes is overlooked as one genre, but it's very diverse, as with any culture. And so the opportunity to explore the diversity, explore the triumphs and also the obstacles in a dynamic way, the military history, but also the tough story of Jim Crow and slavery and find a way to, you know, feed the souls of individuals who visit is what occurs there.
As what principles do you employ when you're telling those difficult stories, when you're talking about slavery and Jim Crow? And those are stories that I think are very shameful for some people and painful for others.
Well, generally, you have this rising action and arc. You know, there's a climax in the middle. So you want to start with the broad national influence or the regional influence, and the apex of the story should be what's difficult to explain. But it's the truth. You have to put the truth in there. Otherwise, you're not, you're not maintaining integrity.
Mm-hmm.
But you need to find a way to release that pain and release patron to the public. So you want to have a falling action and allow the story to unfold and say, well, this is what has occurred. You know, you talk about Jim Crow and KKK, you need to also talk about the rise of African Americans and how they overcame that.
Mm-hmm.
Civil rights movement, you know, you understand the water hoses and sitting in the back of the bus, but now you have, you know, remarkable individuals who found a way to galvanize community thought and action and make way for a new generation. So you tell the hard part, but then also you find a way to allow that patron to, leave fed.
Right. So now also leaving maybe with a sense of triumph,
right,
rather than despair. Speaking of that, what's your take as a black man and a historian on some of the discussions we've had around Confederate monuments recently, with some people saying that taking them down is erasing history?
Well, to be honest, you know, do the research and look at why they went up. A lot of the monuments went up in the 30s and the 40s, some in the 20s, as a result of the period we talked about. So you have this rise of African-American entrepreneurship, the removal of free labor. If you look up this term called peonage and paternalism, and in the black community, African-American land loss, and you have a lot of black empowerment that was occurring during that time. Well, let's put up a monument that reminds African-Americans of the place that they should be. Let's put up a monument to remind the communities about the lost cause, quote-unquote lost cause, the time when we believe America was great. And then you understand why the monuments need to be taken down. If we're saying that these Confederates were traitors and they had to, redeem themselves to be welcomed back into the community, these states had to redeem themselves. You look at the history. So why do we want to honor them by naming streets and buildings, mm-hmm, and erecting monuments to traitors of American vitality? So, you know, what are we preserving? We don't preserve a lot of the community heroes in that manner. So why should these individuals go before?
How well do you think the story, taking back to Florida, the story of Florida's black history has been told? There's probably a lot more of it even than I'm aale of. I feel like I know about Zora Neale Hurston. I know Lift Every Voice and Sing, I think, was actually written by
the Johnson brothers out of Jacksonville.
But is there more to be told? Do you think that we could do a better job? What don't people know about that they should know about?
Well, see, that's the opportunity we have with Florida Humanities. We have individuals such as ourselves and how we express ourselves in our humanity. And Humanities provides that expression avenue, whether it's art criticism, music criticism, lectures. Today we have video casting and radio shows such as yours, expressionism. And these topics that are dear to us and a slice of life can be supported through grants that we have. As a matter of fact, we had a grant recently, Broadcasting Hope, that supported nonprofit activities. And we know that resources for radio can be scarce sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But if we target hope and these things and stories that we're talking about now and provide an avenue for college campuses and professors who are trying to find support for their research, and like with our grant, Greater Good allows professors to do such, we can bring these stories to life. There are small historic societies, small museums that, due to the pandemic, have had challenges. keeping the doors open. And through our grant, American Rescue Plan, we received $2 million this year, about $1 million last year from the NEH, and is more money than this organization has ever received. And we found a way through a wonderful staff. I'll go ahead and name them, Patricia Putman and Lisa Lennox and Brenda. We, you know, they came together in a short amount of time and distributed operating money and support throughout the state of Florida. So these institutions now have the ability to not only stay open, but tell these important stories of communities throughout these 67 counties.
And I want to get back and we'll talk more about Florida Humanities. I'm going to play a promo right now.
The governing body of WMNF, the Nathan B. Stubblefield Foundation, is seeking applications for the board of directors. You may find the application on our website, WMNF.org, in the About section, or call 813-238-8001 and ask to be emailed an application. The deadline to apply is Friday, October 1st at 5 o'clock. That's October 1st at 5 o'clock.
All right. Let's get back to talking about that. You're talking about telling stories, and you're somebody who has been, you're a storyteller, you're a historian, you're a museum professional. Why is that important at all? Why should anybody even care about that?
Well, think about your family. Think about that aunt or uncle that's 80, 90 years old, and they've seen, they've witnessed a change in communities, and they've experienced the horrors we've talked about. And we have the opportunity, or you have the opportunity, to talk to your aunt or uncle and say, what was it like to witness the civil rights movement and having to make a choice between water fountains or going through the front or back door? Or, you know, what was it like to not be recognized coming home from a war that you fought in, but not having respect on American soil? How did that make you feel? Well, he or she tells you that story and nobody else. And that experience, you know, is not captured, not shared. You know, that's a travesty. It's unfortunate. It's great for you or me, but there are a lot of people who want to know what it's like to be a Floridian or a burger or from Tampa or however. And they read about it in a book. But through these activities that help people present stories and exhibitions and public talks, we can find out the truth. We can find out what it was really like. The passion in the story is hard to come across in a storybook sometimes. But you know, this is good work we're doing, and this is a good opportunity.
Well, I think Florida Humanities talks a lot about facilitating conversations.
Yes.
That's what they like to do. There's a lot of, as you said, panel discussions and community events, and as well as exhibits. But it's a give and take. It's a conversation with the intention of helping people get to know each other, get to know their neighbors.
Right. So imagine being in a workplace that, lacks diversity. And you think it lacks diversity until you have a conversation about the confluence of religion, the confluence of values and perceptions. And so unless you have that dialogue or you're comfortable having that dialogue, you won't know that your neighbor could be your friend. And we can't be afraid to learn. I'm not saying agree. I'm not saying absorb or accept someone's diverse opinion or difference in opinion. But understanding the perspective of your neighbor, understanding the perspective of a councilman, allows you to be a good citizen and participate in what we call this social contract in our democracy. We have an event that's occurring tomorrow through Village Square, and I'll be talking with Danielle Allen. Dr. Allen is a Harvard professor and ethicist, and she has a book, Our Democracy, that explores the Declaration of Independence, which outlines how we see or how we should behave in this social contract. But that's a tough discussion because the Declaration of Independence allowed for, a power to take some element of our rights so that we can have the preservation of other rights. And the framers, some of them were slave owners. And Native Americans you know, they did not benefit from that this new country that we live in these past couple hundred years. So there are some conflicts and contradictions there. We have to discuss that because we still own this role in our society. We still have an obligation to participate. And what does that mean? So those are tough discussions facing history and ourselves that we must have. But this platform, this activity tomorrow night at 7 o'clock would allow us to hear from, you know, a renowned scholar of the field. And we hope to continue these types of activities and partnerships.
And how can people access that or participate in that? At 7 o'clock, it's an online event?
Yes, it's free. It's free. It's online. You can register. You go to floridahumanities.org. There's a nice splash page that looks at all of all the grants and activities, Florida Talks as well. But just register online. Go to Eventbrite as well and log in at 7 o'clock.
And she'll be talking about the Declaration of Independence, and it's an interesting conversation about how we want to participate in our democracy. It's a beautiful thing, but understanding that, and we hold up this document as being this perfect document, our founding fathers as being perfect, but they were flawed, and we need to make sense of that now and still participate, even though it was not exactly, there were imperfections.
Yeah, the challenge of...
You don't reject it. We're not rejecting the whole thing because there were problems at the beginning, perhaps.
Right. Well, so the mechanism allows for change, but the change comes from the people when we vote, because we're not in a democracy. We're in a democratic republic. We have representatives. We vote for individuals that we believe are going to represent us or represent our ideals. And we need to know, first, what are our values, our ideals, and make sure that that individual representing us, you know, holds true to that. And if they don't, we need to vote and make that change. But sometimes we don't. Sometimes we ignore that responsibility. And that's the social contract document that the Declaration of Independence represents. But understanding what those words mean and how they work for us is important.
So I'm going to go to an email. We've got an email that I want to read. If you want to send an email or join our conversation, you can email us at dj@wmnf.org, or you can call me at 813-239-9663. So here's an email. I've got Mary from Memphis who says, loving the show, born in Memphis, raised in Rector, Arkansas, where my daddy had a cotton gin and Kennett, Missouri. Hometown folks were appalled because it was segregated. I loved it. New people, whatever that means. And then what she says, she lived in Memphis where she got to converse with Rufus Thomas and Donald Duck Dunn, to name a few. She lived in Nashville for 21 years. And she says, your favorite songs are also mine. Thanks for the work you've done and continue to do. And wants to know if you know Barry Shankman. We're Facebook friends, interesting fellow who had a lot to do with Stax. Is that familiar to you?
Not Barry Shankman, but Donald Duck Dunn. When you played Green Onions, the original group had Louis Steinberg, the bassist. And so Donald Duck Dunn replaced Louis Steinberg and was considered one of the best bassists that you could ever come across, and played on a lot of other sessions and record labels in the Memphis area. It was a major part of the Memphis sound.
I did want to mention, we have another email from somebody named David who wants us to mention, and this is true, that the former director of Florida Humanities was Janine Farver, who was a WMNF former station manager. So there's a connection between WMNF and Florida Humanities. That was a couple directors ago, Farver. Yeah. But he also wants to know what you think. And David, I'm going to ask Nasheed this question, but he's relatively new to the area, about what does he think about the difference between Tampa and St. Petersburg in terms of art galleries, museums, and art shows. And he wants to know how Tampa could catch up to St. Pete. What's your experience so far?
So, yeah, Tampa catching up to St. Pete, I think that if there was some type of community advocacy panel, a group of individuals that looked at this region as a destination, an artistic destination, I think a lot of those challenges could occur. From what I've seen, there is a lot of opportunity for artists in St. Pete, St. Petersburg, Warehouse District, and Tampa, unfortunately, though it has a lot of resources, has not had the opportunity to explore that. But that doesn't mean it can't happen. You know, if a panel of such, and I've seen it happen in Indianapolis, Washington, D.C., Miami, came together and said, how can we pool our resources? There's nothing wrong with two counties saying, well, I have $50,000, you have $50,000. Let's see what our pooled resources can make happen. Now you have an opportunity to get some major exhibitions from some wonderful private collections and have it be safe. You know, Tampa has some wonderful facilities. University of Tampa, I believe, has a new facility and is looking for art, you know.
The Tampa Museum of Art, I think, is expanding. They're getting ready to expand.
So that's a way to bridge opportunity. You have a facility, you have art, cross the water, and see if there's an exchange that can occur.
We've got Harrison from St. Pete on the call. We've got just about 4 minutes left, Harrison, so I'm going to bring you on. What's on your mind real quick? Harrison from St. Pete.
Quickly, I just want him to repeat where this event is going to be hosted tomorrow and what time. The who, what, when, where, and why. Well, we know why, but...
Thank you. He said we know why. I love it. So, 7 p.m. online, you can either go to Eventbrite or go to floridahumanities.org. It's a Zoom event. Mm-hmm. And it would also be, it would also stream Facebook stream, Facebook Live. So there are some avenues there. But the first thing you should do, if you go to floridahumanities.org, the splash page will give you an opportunity to register. It is free at 7 p.m.
floridahumanities.org, that is the website where you can get that.
Yes.
Right? So that's where you can get the information and register. Nasheed, is there any other final words that you have for our listeners? We've got just a few minutes left, and I'm just wondering, what do you want our listeners to know about Florida Humanities and the significance of them to our state?
Well, there are 56 humanities councils across the United States and territories, and all of the councils have an obligation or opportunity to share the identity of its state. But we are a reflection of the stories that are told and captured by the people of this state. And as long as you stay engaged and remain engaged and participate in these activities, they're not just our activities. You know, when we give grants, our partners, the grantees, have programs in your neighborhood, in your community. Attend those. Attend a museum. Become a member of some institution in your community that's trying to preserve culture. Whether it's Hispanic, you have a Holocaust museum, African-American Heritage Societies. And it's not just the history. It could be the music and art of that community. But stay engaged. Share. A lot of these activities are free because we found a way, as we talked about earlier, to galvanize resources and make things available. But if you're not engaged, you're not recording that volunteerism and participating, then that makes the efforts minimal. And sometimes the money disappears.
Nasheed, thanks for being with us. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Listeners, stay tuned for the NPR News up next, followed by Talking Animals with Duncan Strauss. And taking us out of the hour is Nasheed's final Stax song pick, Otis Redding's Try a Little Tenderness.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. This is WMNF Tampa. If you see me but that was Walking By. Now we got Try a Little Tenderness.
Young girls, they do get wearied wearing that same old shaggy dress, yeah, yeah. But when she gets weary, try a little tenderness, yeah. You know she's waiting, just anticipating for things that she'll never, 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 never possess. Yeah, yeah. But
while she's there waiting, and without them, try.